This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
You're listening to iFanboys Talksplode with Steve Lieber. Hey, this is Josh Flanagan with iFanboys Talksplode, and the guest on this episode is Steve Lieber, a fantastic artist and cartoonist who you have seen on many great comic books like The Superior Foes of Spider-Man, The Fix, most recently Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, and way back in Craig Rucka and Whiteout, and a lot of great cartooning in between. We had a nice long conversation about how he came up in the industry, where he came from, the art, the whole thing. It was super fun. And yes, you're going to hear him drawing the entire time in the background. And you can't stop a man from drawing. So that's fantastic. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Josh. Thanks for having me on.
I'm very glad to have you. It's funny because I was thinking you hadn't been on the show, but you have been, just not officially. We were talking to Parker one time and you were in the background, and then I think you pretty much just came on, which is good. And then long time ago, I think we had you on the video show once for a thing.
Sounds right. Maybe back when we were doing Underground.
God, yeah. It was a while ago. I do remember that the first time that I came across your work was Whiteout, and I had gone to San Diego that year. I don't know if it was my first or second year. It would have been 2000, 2001. And you did a sketch from, and I was actually trying to remember the character's name from Whiteout. Is it Carrie? Is that?
No. Correct.
Okay, yeah. And you did this like amazing, this was back in the days where people just sort of did sketches for everybody and there wasn't money really. And you did this like beautiful, thoughtful sketch, and you were flinging actual Whiteout at the paper. And it's one of those like con experiences like, oh, he just did this amazing piece of artwork for me. And that was the first impression that you ever made on me.
One of the things I really miss about doing conventions in person is being able to sketch for people. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get that back. I've been doing lots and lots of commissions on actual postcards for people who give to local causes. Just because I miss doing quick drawings for people, I've been part of the of the Art Commission industrial complex like everybody else, but I really like the connection of just doing something fast for somebody who's read the book. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's a really. it's so easy to go into this like, yeah, things were different, and who knows what it'll be now. But that, you know, that. There was definitely a time, it was probably ending around the time I'm talking about, where, you know, it was a little smaller and a little more intimate, and it was less, you know, just hectic. I remember the first few years I went to San Diego, and it spun out of control really quickly. And, you know, there were other shows that were better where, you know, you would have time and you would be able to talk to people, and it wasn't just a constant sort of fight for space and get in a line and do everything. And I really fell in love with it back then. It's very
different. My first San Diego, I arrived in town without having made any arrangements for where to sit at the con, and I was able to just get table space by showing up and telling them that I did a book for DC Comics. And I knew people who would come to San Diego with no room reservation, figuring that they'd be able to find something once they arrived in town.
That just sounds like a fantasy now.
Yeah, it's an alien world. I feel like one of the weird costume nomads in the Road Warrior talking about the old days.
So, how did you sort of originally get involved in comics? Were you a lifelong reader? Did it come along later?
Started just about the time I was able to make out what letters were.
Oh yeah.
I still have my very first comic. I got an issue of a Submariner comic, Tales to a Stop. I can't remember what the actual title of the comic is, but it was a Roy Thomas and Maurice Severin Submariner comic that my dad found on the street or picked up at a flea market or something when I was 5 years old. And at some point in my childhood, I went through it and I re-inked all the Namor figures with a ballpoint pen. which makes Maurice Severin my first artistic influence.
And you still have that specific issue?
I still have that comic it was coverless, and mm-hmm. at some point I cut out the Marvel Value stamp. But yeah, it's still in my possession. Maurice Severin was actually really important to me for that and for another reason. She was the first comics pro I ever met when I was like 10 years old. I got my mom to drop me off at a comic con held in Monroeville Mall, a big shopping mall on the outskirts of Pittsburgh. It's most famous for having been where they shot Dawn of the Dead. And they held a comic con there with dealers and artists just kind of sitting outside the food court or whatever. My mom dropped me off with a dollar. So I bought a hot dog or something, and that was it. And so it's like 1976 or 77, and I'm walking around with no money, and my mom's going to come pick me up in a few hours. And I'm looking at all these old comics, and I'm getting kind of hyper and miserable at the same time because there's no reprints in those days. Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing thousands of comics with awesome covers that I know I'll never get to read. And it's just kind of dawning on me how much awesome stuff there is that I'll never, ever be allowed to take a look at. And this nice old lady waves me over. Oh, she's probably younger than I am now. And says, hey, kid, come here. You want a drawing or something? And I realized who she was. And I said, yeah. And she said, who should I draw? And I said, Doc Savage, because I was a weird kid. And she pulled out a black magic marker and a pad of paper and no pencil prep, just working in big, broad ink strokes, drew a beautiful full-figure Doc Savage sketch and gave it to me.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, I've never had any experience like that in my life up to that point. I'd never seen an adult draw, I think. Mm-hmm. Much less, you know, a 25, 30 year pro like Maurice Severin was at that point.
I was older, but I had an experience vaguely similar. The first time it was called Ithacon. It was in Ithaca, New York. And I was in college, so I was probably 19. 20, something like that. And it's this tiny little, I'm picturing it as like in like the smaller banquet room of a hotel or something like that. and Walt Simonson, Louise Simonson were there at a table, and I just sort of started reading comics again after a really short little stint when I was a kid. But I recognized him because I remembered those Thor issues, and I said, you know, can you do a Thor for me? That would be really cool. And he'd done some heads because it was just a line, and people were asking. I think we drew it on a backboard or something like that. And I said, can you put the hammer in it? And he looked at me like, you're gonna make requests? And I was like, so, you know, but he did. He did this really, and I'm looking at it right now. It's on my wall, and you know, and he finished it, and he sort of made that face like, oh, it's pretty good. And he showed it to, he's like, Wheezy, look at this, you know, like it. And it was just this really nice little moment. And I, you know, that I feel like that made a real impact on me in terms of, you know, really coming to love the art form and the medium and the community and everything. So sounds like you had
it sounds like we're both pretty lucky to have met, you know, consummate gentleman professional.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I, you know, I met him for real years later, and he was, you know, even cooler than I had sort of thought back then. So it was a really nice bookend to that, I think.
One of the first San Diegos where I was like a listed guest, they seated me in Artist Alley just two seats away from Marie Severin.
Oh wow.
So I had to go over and tell her that story and tell her how I took her drawing home and copied it over and over and how it set me on the path of doing this for a living. And she just said, oh Christ, I'm sorry.
That's about right for the comics tone of, yeah. So given that point, you know, when did you sort of, you know, were you always drawing as a kid, or like, when was the point where you thought this would be a thing I could do?
Not always, but I would go through obsessive phases when I would do it a lot. I was always reading comics and reading them and rereading them and studying them obsessively. So I was never about just making pictures. It was always about comics as stories. You know, the act of laying one picture next to another one to tell a story. And as I got obsessed with comics, I started doing everything I could to learn more about them. My local library only had like 5 books in their entire comics, et cetera, listing in their Dewey catalog. So I read all of those and Jules Pfeiffer's book and the book Comics with an X, which was another history of comic books and strips. And at some point I learned that the comic strips of the newspapers actually used to be good. So I started rereading the Pittsburgh Press's comics pages on microfilm from the 30s and 40s.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so I was 10 years old and reading years worth of Terry the Pirates one day at a time.
Yeah, you never had a chance at any other industry. You kind of had to do this at that point, huh?
Oh, I was crazy and obsessive. But it didn't really seem like something that I could do. I know I mentioned that I'd never seen an adult draw. I didn't know anybody who had done anything creative with their life. My dad was a salesman and miserable about it. My mom was a housewife and later started several businesses that failed. I didn't know anybody who could. I didn't even know what a freelancer was. It just didn't seem like a possible thing. But I had gotten a copy of Origins of Marvel Comics, the Stan Lee book, and in there I learned that Stan Lee was born Stan Lieber, and that lit a bell there. You know, suddenly, if Stan Lieber could do it, why can't Steve Lieber? It just didn't seem like that big of a leap.
I don't think I've ever made that connection, but yeah, that's a very specific one. So were you understanding, you know, the mechanics of comics? Because we have, you know, I think it's a, you know, we have so many resources now where you can read and like, oh, storytelling is important and here's how scripts work, or here, you know, as you said, there's sort of a dearth of information. If you didn't know anybody, like, was it starting to come together how the art form worked for you?
I had a couple of paths towards accumulating that information. One was the big library in Pittsburgh, the one I had to take like a half hour bus to get to. had this giant reprint volume of old EC comics. And one of the stories reprinted in there was Bernie Krigstein's Master Race, a famous great comic story, one of the high watermarks of 20th century comic book storytelling. And I'm proud to say that as an 11-year-old reading that story, I could tell that this was something different. I could feel like neurons making connections in my brain. It was the first time that I was aware of that a picture could be quiet or loud, which is a strange thing to say, but it's now it's just how many artists think about composition. And it was the first time I'd seen an artist consciously manipulate time by the way they sliced up panels. If there's a visual thing to go with this talk, you can grab some pages from the story and run it along with it, and people instantly see what I'm talking about. But that was the moment right there, reading that story, that I went from being aware of the characters in the story to being aware that there's someone who's making these things. I could feel the puppets. I could feel the puppeteer's hands on the marionette. Mm-hmm. And that started me thinking really, really hard about it. And after that, it was, I just started accumulating info in all the usual ways. When I was in high school, the Marvel tryout book came out. And there was How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way book. Mm-hmm. So those started helping me put pieces together. And I was reading Criticism and the Comics Journal. But what made the biggest difference for me was going to the Joe Kubert School. I was a student at Penn State on a scholarship for their business administration thing, because again, I still didn't see a path to making comics as a livelihood. I'll skip the weird coincidences that led to this, but I wound up meeting somebody who went to the school at the exact moment that I was reading about it, and suddenly the school went from being this distant pie in the sky thing to a real thing that someone I just talked to had attended. I gave up my full ride scholarship at Penn State studying business to instead go spend thousands of dollars at a trade school that teaches about comic books. You can imagine how happy my dad was on that one.
That was exactly the question I was thinking of. Yes, I was like, oh my God.
This would be a page in my origin story right here. When I told my dad that I was giving up the full scholarship to go study comic books, he took out an ad in the local Penny Saver newspaper and sold my bid. I got to give him credit. It was a hell of a gesture. It's like you could fuck up your life, but you're not going to do it on my dime.
And now you're in comics. You showed him.
Yeah. We talked a few years later.
And we can laugh about it now. So
yes. Yeah. Well, he's dead. Yeah.
You know. Well,
it was a tough relationship for several years.
Yeah.
But it also made me. It was a useful kick in the ass, I guess. It made it clear to me that there's no plan B here, that I'm going to have to get good and figure out how to support myself doing this.
What kind of awakening was it to sort of be around, you know, at the Kubert School and be around people who had done it for a living and other people who were? I mean, did it
amazing.
Yeah.
I was sharing a house with a whole bunch of other people who were just as obsessed as I was. There's original art on the walls by Hal Foster and Joe himself and mm-hmm. Jose Luis Salinas and other great, great, great artists, Alex Raymond. There's people who've solved every problem that I'm ever going to run into a million times that I can go and ask questions of. It was a great education. It involved living in Jersey for 3 years, which is its own thing.
Sure.
I learned a lot. At this point, people ask me, should I go to art school? Should I self-teach? And it's not necessary. Nobody's ever asked to see my certificate of completion from the place. No one cares about where you study. They only care about what's in your portfolio. I think I needed that structure to learn, despite all my obsessiveness about comics. I wouldn't have knuckled down and learned the basics that are the foundation of my career without them. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely the right thing for me. That said, I know lots of other artists who are completely self-taught who can draw circles around me.
It's interesting because I've talked to a good number of people, you know, in this format who had gone to the Kubert School, and not all of them, several of them didn't, you know, become artists between, you know, Kubert and SCAD. And it isn't always, you know, I was talking to Donnie Cates, and I didn't realize that he had gone to Kubert School, or was it SCAD? Didn't matter. He'd gone in as an artist, and he's like, I realized I didn't have that in me, but he still like uses a thing to learn and sort of move forward. And there's been lots of people like that. I think Joe Caramagno is another one who went to the Kubert School, and it's the same thing. He came out of it and he's like, well, I want to work in comics, but I'm not gonna be able to, you know, do this from an art standpoint. But it really is such a constant in at least a certain generation. I don't know if it'll be the same thing going forward, but I'm thinking that when you were there is probably a little bit of a sweet spot in terms of who was there and what was going on and how it, you know, like the sort of timing. I like the idea that, you know, you had time-wise, you had feet in sort of the early Silver Age and you know, through the 50s and you know, what an amazing talent, like a pool of talent to sort of choose from who'd been through all of, you know, all of that development in comics, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's, you know, the downside to having teachers who, you know, a lot of my teachers were working in comics since the Second World War.
Sure.
The downside to that is that I came out of art school in 1990, having never sat behind a computer. Mm-hmm.
And you were smoking a cigar, and you were wearing suspenders, and.
You know, dipping my brush into a shot glass full of whiskey. A lot of the techniques we learned were state of the art for 1957. Mm-hmm. but the principles are eternal, and there's stuff I learned in my first month there that I still use every day.
Give me an example.
Tricks for constructing, perspective. This is a phrase that's meaningless to someone who doesn't draw for a living, but how to hang a head on the horizon and line figures up so that they don't look like they're standing in midair or floating out of the floor. Mm-hmm. When you're constructing a three-dimensional space without looking at it, without using any reference.
That's interesting. It makes, you know what, that description makes me think of in the earliest days of CGI. It never looked like any of the things were on the surface they were on. I don't know if that's at all related, but that's the first thing it made me think of. But it's funny because I always remember the first time I must have been 10 or 11, first time I read How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way, when they were describing, you know, the vanishing point and perspective and stuff like that. It blew my mind. I thought, oh, there's a whole other thing going on here that I didn't even know.
And the anatomy teacher there was this wonderful maniac named Benito Ruiz. He was, I don't think he ever did anything that appeared in comics, but he was, he'd been a commercial artist since the 1950s and was a very, very systematic teacher whose entire approach to pedagogy he learned being trained to be in the infantry in World War II. So the way he taught us was the way his drill instructor taught him. And it was funny and it was brutal. Let's see if I can give a bit of the taste of it.
Yeah, I'm having a little trouble making the connection.
Okay, what you're going to do is you're going to draw that figure on the model stand in front of you. Now, you're not going to draw the model. I do not want a picture that looks like the model. You are going to draw an 8-head mannequin of that model from your point of view. Yeah, with the eye level at the waistline right here. When you've drawn this, you are not going to put your name in the lower right hand corner like you're signing this thing. You are not creating a work of art. You are repeating back the information that you have been given. You are not here to express yourself because you are first year art students and you have nothing to express but your own ignorance. And he can do it without taking a breath. Yeah. Man, it was really something.
You were born again hard that day.
Oh God, he was glorious. I miss him every day of my life. He was wonderful.
So you go through Qbert. You know, what is the next step? There could be a long road in between sort of getting out of that school and having a career.
I've told this story a lot, but I'll
yeah, I apologize.
Quickly here. it's a good story. I finished up at the Qbert School. I'm going to move back to Pittsburgh and stay at my parents for a while.
There's no bed there. You can't.
Yeah, not at my dad's. Yeah, that's gone. But I could stay on my mom's couch for a little while and figure out what the next move is. So I ship everything I've drawn over the 3 years back to Pittsburgh. 50-pound box of completed artwork, all my entire output for 3 years of art school, and UPS loses the box. So I arrive back home. UPS apologizes and sends me a check for $100 to replace the valuable stuff that they've lost. I start trying to recreate my portfolio, which it's going to take a while. And this is before digital storage of any kind. So there's no record of anything. All I had was the originals. I get a crappy job telemarketing and start spending every night trying to recreate my portfolio so I can start hitting the ad agencies looking for storyboard work and start submitting comic samples to publishers. Couple months into my telemarketing job, I'm at home. I get a call from a student I had known at the Qbert School. She and her husband were first year students while I was a third year, and I'd helped them out with some stuff. And she called because she just gotten a job at a drugstore in Jersey. And she was going through, she was doing some inventory in the basement, and she found a giant box with my name on it.
Oh my God.
And yeah, it was my 50-pound box of artwork. She arranged to have it shipped to me. I got it. I had my portfolio all suddenly intact. I started making calls to ad agencies, and the very first place that I showed my portfolio, I got work, and I haven't really been out of work since.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah.
So was that the plan that you had? Like, forgetting, notwithstanding the lost boxes or anything, but that was the first plan is sort of go for storyboard work with ad agencies, and then that would set you up for a bit.
Yeah, I knew that Pittsburgh had a lot of advertising agencies, and it didn't have much of an art program at in their local schools, so that I would have a pretty good advantage over the local artists, and indeed I did, which is why I was able to get hired so quickly. So I did that for like a year and a half while getting my comics stuff together. It was interesting. I came out of Qbert's knowing what it would take to produce professional work. And I was about 85% there. I just needed another 20, 30 pages under my belt. Just needed to get a few more rookie mistakes out of the way before people would want to start hiring me. And my way into comics was a pretty usual way in those days. I did mini comics. I did small press stuff where I made $5 a page for inking and lettering and hand lettering on a book. I did some paid samples for writers who were trying to pitch things.
How did you get hooked into those scenes?
Talking to people, I made sure that, the folks at the local comic shop knew who I was. Mm-hmm. And so that if people were looking for an artist, they could mention me. I mailed samples. This was my big thing for actually getting into the paying markets. On the first day of every month, I would mail a new 8-page packet of samples to every single editor and assistant editor in the business. This is in the snail mail days, so we're talking about a Leaning Tower of Pisa of Manila envelopes. Mm-hmm. like $70 a month in postage. But I kept doing new batches of samples. I kept getting better, and I was showing the publishers that I could make a deadline before I had a deadline. If they're getting new samples from me the same day of every month, they could see that I'm serious about this. It's hard. I've much sympathy for any editor who wants to hire new talent, but doesn't know what they're getting into when they hire somebody who's never been published before.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people flake. I've known some terrific artists. They're like playground legends in basketball. Mm-hmm. In their own league, doing their own thing, they're fantastic, but they're not really wired to do this professionally. And it's no slight. It's just whether you're wired for it.
Well, the flip side of that, though, is that you've then also got to prove to yourself that you're not that person, or to them that you're not that person.
Exactly. And for me, my way of doing it was just constantly sending new samples, a new batch every month, a different genre. For some folks, they got a full year of those batches of samples. It showed them that I was unlikely to flake, because I just kept producing even though no one was paying me to do it. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, one of those samples actually got published. A friend of mine, a guy named Jeff Lang, who had run the comic shop at Penn State, had written this great short story. It was an 8-page story. I drew it up. I inked it. I hand lettered it. And I sent it off as a sample, and it arrived, on the desk of whoever was editing Dark Horse Presents. It might've been Bob Schreck. Just as some other freelancer had flaked and blown a deadline and wasn't going to turn in the 8-page story that he owed them. So they got this thing for me, and it was 8 pages long. It was already lettered. There weren't too many spelling mistakes in it. Mm-hmm. And they called me up and said, "Has this been published?" And I said, no, it's just a sample. And they said, could we run this? And I said, let me check with my secretary. They ran it. They paid me and the writer for it, and we were off.
Oh wow, that's a fun thing. Now you're getting into comics, professionally at a time when things are really taking off. Did that? Yeah. Were you feeling?
Well, I didn't benefit from it the way that I would have liked. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's 1992 at this point. Image is starting to metastasize and becoming the big, that slice of comics is becoming the biggest thing in the world. And as I said, I was drawing, stuff that was state of the art for 1955. I used to joke that it's like I'd come out of music school, knowing how to sing like Dean Martin, and the whole world wanted Metallica. but there were I was always able to find. Once I started getting work, I was always able to find one more job that wanted the kind of storytelling that I did.
Did you think of your art like that? Or like, was that something that you learned? Or is that style like just inherently what you would do?
It was a combination. My sensibility is, like I mentioned earlier, making an interesting picture was never interesting to me. Mm-hmm. All I cared about was narrative. And I think that led me towards ways of drawing that weren't all that focused on being exciting or expressive. I wanted to downplay things and let the impacts come from juxtaposition, from putting one picture smartly next to another, and letting the explosions detonate in the reader's mind rather than on the page.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel? Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because you can say like it felt like an older style, and what you're talking about is just good storytelling to me. And I think like when I first came across your work, I was not an astute reader. I don't think I could have really, but. It's different. You're right. It's not bombastic, but in a way, and now, I have hindsight, I can say, well, geez, it was actually very modern, because now, it seems to fit right in. And it's, that kind of, storytelling focused, simple is not the right word. Clean. I could go with that. I think of it as cartooning, that seems very modern. It seems current. It's of the time. And I mean, do you think you're doing things the same way that you always were, or I don't know, how do you look at it? I guess
I think I'm doing it. What I'm doing now is what I was trying to do a long time ago.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. With personal improvement.
For it. Yeah. It's funny. The word that I tend to use for it is what I got from, David Mamet talking about film. He talks a lot about the uninflected shot. Meaning that a movie is created by one unexceptional shot set next to another unexceptional shot, which creates a meaning by their juxtaposition. And it's not about putting the camera somewhere exciting and seeing people from a wild and distorted angle or anything like that. The example he gives in his book on directing film is from Casablanca, where the biggest moment in Humphrey Bogart's life is signaled by him taking a beat, turning to his piano player, and nodding his head. but it's the moment when Rick decides, go ahead and play the Marseillaise. I'm going to stand up against fascism after all. But it's all done with just a single nod of the head. I don't think I'd read Mamet at that point, but I'd read Hitchcock, Truffaut, and been studying Alex Toth stuff, like it was Talmud. Just really trying to assimilate all these influences of people who were deeply story focused. Mm-hmm. One of the exercises that I used to do for myself, and that I recommend to young artists all the time, is I would watch old movies, stuff from, you know, before 1960, didn't matter what it was, with the sound off, and see how much of the story I could follow, how much I could understand about what's going on and who these characters are, just from the pictures. And it's a tremendously useful exercise for any artist who wants to really grasp the visual grammar of storytelling. And once you see it being done so well and so gracefully, without doing anything flashy or showy, putting the flashy or showy stuff in just feels like bad taste.
Oh yeah, I get that. It's totally an aesthetic thing, but I wonder, do you feel like it was difficult to find enough people who appreciated that, both in terms of like editors and in terms of readers?
Well, I'd occasionally bump heads. Like I was hired at DC by Archie Goodwin, who's someone who's very sympathetic to the way that I worked. But he had to pass me off to a much younger and very, very new editor who every month would send me packages of look at what Joe Madd's doing on Battle Chasers. Couldn't you draw like this? It literally just send me other artists who wished I would draw like. I had to fight with that for a while. But for most of my career, people hired me because they could see what I was good at.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Are you drawn to, let me rephrase. I feel like I see that type of art with those kinds of considerations a lot more frequently now than, you know, that would have been highlighted then. Like now I can think of a good number of people who I think, you know, are really strong storytellers. Their characters act. There are things. It's not about a splash page. It's not like things have changed. You know, do you feel like it's changed in terms of
definitely.
Yeah,
absolutely. There's still plenty of folks who only want colorful explosions on every page and things lit from four different light sources. And it used to be that they wanted that done in at the ink stage. Now they want that done in the color stage. But there's so much more room for individual approaches and for artists to follow their own muse and to express their own notions of what a good story is than I ever imagined there would be, even coming out of the heady days of the mid 80s and early 90s.
Mm-hmm. Now, had you always pretty much worked with writers, or did you try to write your own stories as well?
One of my biggest regrets as a cartoonist is that I haven't pursued writing more. Mm-hmm. In the early days, there was always one more paying gig that I had to take on, so I never really had time to sit down and concentrate and write anything. Now it would be no problem for me to write something and get someone to publish it. There's
right.
There's at least three publishers who've said they'll take anything that I do.
That must be a nice feeling.
It is a nice feeling.
Yeah.
It's funny. After 30 years of this, now my favorite thing about drawing a comic is solving the puzzle of the script. Mm-hmm. And when I've drawn my own stories, and I've written a few.
Yeah.
But I enjoy drawing my own stories so much less than I enjoy drawing other people's. It's like when I'm drawing a story that I wrote, it feels like solving a crossword puzzle that I designed. Mm-hmm. You know, suddenly it's just I'm just filling in cells in an Excel sheet or something instead of trying to get inside somebody's head it's deeply frustrating because I know that it shouldn't be like that, mm-hmm. but when it comes to drawing, I really get the most pleasure from interpreting a complete story.
So, I first came across your stuff with Whiteout, and that was really right when I was first sort of getting into comics. I was going to say seriously, but I put air quotes around that. But when I start recognizing it as an art form, you know, and start to really understand the intricacies of how it works, and I think that was a really interesting time because, you know, the bankruptcies had happened, comics were not doing great a lot. And then all of a sudden you had this sort of creative groundswell, I think, where comics were really great for a while before it was like people were like, well, there's no money in this. Let's make really good comics. How did you look at that time? Did it feel like, oh no, what are we going to do? Did it feel freeing or, you know?
Well, I mean, let's see. The early 80s for me was just a wildly exciting time to be reading comics. And at that point, I wasn't thinking that I could do it professionally. But I remember going into Phantom of the Attic, my local comic shop in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and saying, I'm really loving this Swamp Thing comic and this Thor comic. It's like they both, I didn't have the vocabulary for it, but it's like each of them creates its own whole world inside the comic. What else is like that? Mm-hmm. And God bless him, the owner of that store, manager Jeff Yandora, still owns it, walked me over and handed me a copy of Love and Rockets. Mm-hmm. And that set my brain on fire. I never read anything like that. And it was Jaime Hernandez, 35 years later, remains still my favorite working cartoonist. Just an unbelievable storyteller. And so all through the ups and downs of comic book industry insanity, storytellers like him were a North Star to follow. Mm-hmm. And there would always be a bunch of stuff coming out that I just had no interest in. But that didn't matter. You know, what didn't matter were the five or six books that I picked up that really did blow me away. And there was always somebody doing something unexpected, something nifty.
Do you still like have comics that make you feel that way that are coming out today? Or do you still read any stuff that comes out?
Well, I have to leave the house to get a lot of it. But let's see. One comic that just blew me away, utterly blew me away recently, was by a studio mate of mine, Dylan McConus. And she, God bless her, she hand-painted a 400-page graphic novel.
Good Lord.
400 pages of water watercolor, and I got it. It came out in hardcover, and I sat down and I blasted through it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Holy shit, that was amazing!" And it's a middle grade story about a young girl who doesn't yet know that she's a queen in exile, and reading it, I was an 11-year-old girl, man. I was, oh, this is the best. This is the absolute best story. And you know, having finished that 400 pages, I immediately sent an email to the author asking, when's the next one coming?
Yeah.
Yeah, they love that.
I've done exactly that. He's a friend of mine now, but Box Office Poison by Alex Robinson was like, it's a 600-page book. He worked on it forever. And I bought it, and I I read through it in a day, and I did the same thing. I sent him, I didn't know him, but I sent him an email, and I was like, I just really appreciate that. I think I bought a couple of pages, and I was like, I read it one day, and he just was like, you know, that took me forever. And I was like, I'm sorry.
Yeah, the time it took to make that was yep. my youth.
Yeah, yeah. And I've always remembered that, though. I'm like, all right, don't say I sucked your whole story in one gulp. What do you have now? That's funny. Yeah.
Another book that just knocked my socks off was The Hard Tomorrow by Eleanor Davis. She's an artist out of somewhere in Georgia. I believe she teaches at or taught at SCAD. Mm-hmm. She's mostly an illustrator for like the New York Times and stuff like that, but she's also a spectacularly talented cartoonist. And this book, The Hard Tomorrow, is a very, very near future story about people coping with a devolving political situation in the U.S. I wonder why it was so affecting. But you know, she's able to draw with incredible expressive beauty in every panel, but still never make the individual panels upstage the story. I don't know if it's clear what I'm talking about there. I've never taken.
I mean,
it
sounds related to what you were talking about earlier in the David Mamet quote.
Yeah, I'm never taken out of the story thinking to myself, you know, wow, that's an impressive piece of ink work or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But every single panel of the story is a gorgeous object in and of itself, and a functional piece of comics making as well.
That's a really interesting aspect of good comic book art, I've noticed, is that like...
Yeah.
In order to work really well, you have to have, it's almost like you can't notice it, but it's antithetical to itself. I've noticed this a lot. You just, yeah. that's a hell of a challenge for you to have to work with.
Mm-hmm. For me, yeah, my natural inclinations have never been to try to impress with individual visuals. So it was never a problem. I've known some artists who've really had to work to knock that down.
Mm-hmm.
One of my studio mates was a classically trained painter and has remarkable facility. Holy cow, can he illustrate? Can he draw? Can he paint? In his earlier stuff, you would wind up with panels competing with each other. Because you know it's like looking at a band, and every single member of the band is trying to rush to the front of the stage and solo at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken like conscious effort on his part to not put as much in as he's capable of.
Hmm. So I'm going to skip forward a little bit here.
Oh, sure.
Because I could go on forever.
Let's get to Jimmy.
When I think, when you started doing Spear Your Foes of Spider-Man with Nick Spencer, and I read, I was looking, and I said that was 2013, which I can't believe that was that long ago. I feel like that was, you know, a real moment for you and for, you know, sort of like... I guess having sort of another good time sort of starting up in comics, because you know you're doing an action book, but it's a comedy book, and you've done a lot of work like that since then, and that's become, I mean, I don't know if you think you're getting pigeonholed or anything like that, but it's a real strength. You know, there's been like, there's not a lot of people who can make a comic book page, you know, where the acting is the part of it that's laugh out loud funny. And, you know, I find that super impressive. You know, it was, tell me about it or what you think of what I said.
No, when I accepted the job, I didn't know the book was going to be a comedy. And I'm
really
not sure. I'm not sure if Nick Spencer did either. Nick only writes a couple of pages at a time. So I was only getting script three or four pages at a time. And there'd be a moment or a line in that was kind of funny. And I would deliver that laugh as best I could and then try to put something else that's just in the pictures that's also funny. Mm-hmm. And then Nick would get that batch of pages and he would try to top what I had just given him. And you know, he started to see that, oh, okay, we could actually, you know, as a team, we could actually be funny together. Mm-hmm. And the book went from just a wise guy villain book to a sitcom. Somebody described us as It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia in spandex, and I think that's a very fair comparison. But when I accepted, I had no idea that I could even do comedy.
Well, that was my question. I mean, I knew you, I knew your work before then, but I remember thinking like, wait, was he always funny? And I didn't, you know, but it really was a thing. Did you know Nick before that?
No.
Wow.
I think he and Steve Wacker at Marvel had seen the 10 pager I did in Matt Fraction's Hawkeye run, and seeing that, saw that I had the right naturalism for what Nick, for the crime type superhero book that Nick was writing. It was very, very exciting to find out that I could actually do funny on paper. It helped that I was sharing a studio with three of the funniest people in comics, Jeff Parker, Colleen Coover, and Ben Dewey. So I had great people to bounce things off of, and I could, you know, I could hold up two different layouts and say which of these is funnier, and they could point to, and say, you know, that go with that one. That kind of thing helped a lot. And it also really helped that we were on a book that absolutely no one in Marvel cared about, and most people at Marvel didn't know they were publishing. it is.
Yeah. By the way, it's never a good sign if I really like a book. That's.
I'm right there with you. Yeah. We debuted as part of some kind of Spider Month or something like that. And then when people saw that Spider-Man wasn't actually in our comic, the sales started plunging and never stopped. We just hemorrhaged readers all through that run. But what quickly happened is that people in the office started reading it and liking it, and that was all that mattered. Because I think in the end they let us finish the run because they wanted to see what happened.
Yeah. It really was a thing. That's really interesting. Because he was writing it piecemeal and you guys were, God, that's the closest I've ever heard to sort of improv in a comic book series. But like, did it turn into a thing then that it maybe wasn't necessarily going to be?
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
wow.
It was always going to be about Boomerang bringing together the Sinister Six or Five or whatever, the Sinister Several. I don't think Nick would have pitched a sitcom to, to Marvel Comics, and I don't think Marvel Comics would have greenlit it. It's just because it was being done so organically that we were able to do that kind of thing. For most of the issues, pages only came in batches of like two or three at a time. Very frequently, I had no idea what the scene I was drawing had to do with the rest of the story. When I got to the reveal of Silvermane's head on the car, I was as surprised as any reader.
That's specifically what I was thinking. I was like, well, then he must not have had that in mind originally, and that was sort of born of your collaboration.
Yeah, there were there were times when I would get a when I would hit a surprise of the script, and I would just go and throw the script across the room out of shock. Like, what the? That's nuts. That's insane. Always an appreciation, but never frustration. But it was entirely seat of the pants. I think readers were constantly surprised because we were constantly surprised.
Yeah. Well, that you're sort of, you know, I was trying not to use the word vibing off each other, but you know, you're reacting to each other as you're creating a thing. And I mean, that's not how comics get made most of the time.
No. When I did that, I would have said that I couldn't deliver funny any other way because, you know, the scripts were, you know, sometimes they were Marvel style. Sometimes they were just 3 pages of dialogue with no visual instructions. Sometimes it literally said, maybe something funny happens here. So there was a lot of room for improv and plenty of places for me to do the thing that I knew could work. I could read a script and see 6 or 7 different possibilities for how to tell what he's put down on what he's given me, and I can choose the funniest one. And I wasn't sure if I could be as funny given a much more traditional script that says panel one, here's a panel description, here are the words. But then I worked with Matt Fraction on Jimmy, and Matt's scripts are super tight. Everything's there. He knows what tier, how many tiers of panels there are on a page, and which panels are on which tier. And he's a formalist. He thinks very, very hard about how things are arranged on a comics page. But he's also really, really funny, and every single thing he asked for, all I had to do was draw what he asked for, and the laugh would arrive.
Do you normally like to have, you know, a script that gives you more looseness, or could you work? I mean, I'm sure you can work with either, but what is it you normally prefer?
I've worked from incredibly loose to incredibly tight. Mm-hmm. My favorite are scripts that give me some room to maneuver. I like to know what needs to be accomplished on a page, and then I like to be able to improvise based on that. I like to throw in extra panels for characters to take a beat or to pause between saying something. Even if I'm not, I prefer to do my own lettering, but even if I'm not, I always turn in a lettered version anyhow so that the rest of the team can see what I was thinking for the rhythm of a page. Mm-hmm.
I just made a face like if somebody does, like if a chef put food in front of you and it was beautiful looking, just because to have you say, I like to do my own lettering, I'm just like, oh. Because it doesn't, it's a thing that doesn't exist anymore. And I was trying to explain to somebody about how hand lettering is the best, but there's only like 12 people in the world who really think that anymore. It was a non-comics friend of mine. I was like, did you write that by hand? And I was like, hand lettering in comic book is the best thing. And he's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, don't worry about it. It won't matter to anybody else.
Yeah, it's, it makes things, despite the aesthetic beauty of it and how wonderful it is on the original art and just how satisfying good hand lettering can be,
yeah.
It makes everybody else's job so much harder that I just feel guilty demanding that they go with my hand lettering. Or with lettering on the original art. Both Matt and Nick and other writers I've worked with Jeff Parker, James A. Smith, you know, are all very, very diligent about doing a second pass after they get the artwork, mm-hmm. and taking out dialogue if there's places where the pictures communicate everything that needs to be said. Adding new lines, adding new jokes if they see a place for it. Fine-tuning things so that it's an organic product rather than just the result of an assembly line. And if you've got a book that's hand-lettered with the lettering on the page, you lose the flexibility to do that. Suddenly, if you want to take out a word balloon, you have to create the artwork that hand-drawn word balloon would have covered up. Mm-hmm. And for the forward editions, it's nightmarish. I think it was the German translation of Whiteout, and that was already it was hand-lettered and a pretty wordy, dense book. It was Greg's first comic, so he hadn't got the brevity that characterizes a lot of his later writing. And when you take all that stuff and then translate it into German, suddenly there's just not no physical room inside the word balloons I'd drawn for all that dialogue. They would have to slam it down to this ridiculously small font just to fit it all in.
German, now that I think about it, doesn't really seem like a language that lends itself to comic book lettering in general. So you're double hit there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Actually, let me go back a little bit now. You know, that collaboration with Greg Rucka was certainly a big deal for him and for you. How did that come about?
I had worked for Bob Schreck on some stuff at Dark Horse years prior. And he had kept me in mind. He liked what I did, and he had just formed Oni Press with Joe Nosmak. They were a startup in 1997, and somebody, I think maybe Matt Wagner, had introduced Greg to Bob and showed them Greg's debut script, the very first comic he'd ever written, Whiteout number one. Hmm. And they liked it. And it was apparently in 97, it wasn't easy to find somebody who could draw that kind of material. It needed to be black and white because they didn't have a budget for color. They needed someone who could do naturalism because the story didn't call for glamorous heroic types. They needed someone who could conjure up the environment because Antarctica was an active presence in the story, not just a background or a lack of background. So there weren't a whole lot of people who could do that, and there were very few people who could do it for what Oni was able to offer. I think they probably showed it to two or three people before me, but I had just moved to Portland. And I don't remember this, but apparently Bob sent Greg Rucka over to my table to check out my stuff and see what he thought of my work. And Greg liked it. I think he bought some Batman prints for me or something. And they offered it to me, and I took it on. At that point, my career was not in a very good place. Mm-hmm. I was having a hard time lining up things. I managed to keep busy, but it wasn't easy, and the jobs were getting less glamorous all the time. And I was starting to wonder if I was going to have to get a day job. But I took this one on because this script that Bob had given me for Whiteout number one was the best thing I'd ever read. Mm-hmm. I had never seen a comic script that good in my life, and I knew I could knock it out of the park. And I'd also been on the assembly line a lot. I used that term before, where stuff where I, the editor would tell the writer what to write. The writer would tell me what to pencil. I would tell the, would give it to an inker. The inker would give it to a color artist. Nobody was communicating with each other. People were working across purposes. The end results of that first few years of work just weren't very good. And I felt like, okay, if I'm going to be one of those guys who comics chews up and spits out, let me do one thing that I'm really proud of, and one book that looks exactly the way I want it to look. And with this, I knew I could get that. I loved the story. I knew I could make it sing. I knew I could make it look like the art in my sketchbooks rather than the assembly line comics that had my name on them. And I could control every bit of it because they didn't have the budget. There wasn't going to be any color on top of it. They were fine with me doing my own hand lettering. I could do all the cool stuff with gray tones that was intriguing me. I gave a year to those four issues, I knew I had something special from the very first scene. It was just a wonderful experience.
That's fantastic. In the middle of that, I was going to ask you, did you know? But clearly, you knew it was something special.
I didn't know if it would find an audience, because that's never a given.
Certainly not then.
No. I knew that at least for me, it would finally be a comic the kind of comic that was the reason I went to art school in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that was a very good time era for comics like that. And I think that, because I came in at that time, as I came back to reading and I was an adult and I was, sort of looking for something out of it. And there was, for that 5 years after that or so, people were able to make comics in the mainstream that weren't sort of just the same thing. And it was, it's people who knew what they were doing, but because, people didn't have a lot to lose. You got all these different types of stories that, they existed before, but on a much, smaller scale. I always look at it as it was such a great time for me to become a reader again and to become involved with the industry as I did sort of during that time. And I your book was definitely one of those at that point where I thought, oh, there can be comics like this about people. To this day, I will read a solicitation for something and I'll get to the supernatural twist. I'm like, oh, just make it people. It's a real bugaboo of mine.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah, because it can. It doesn't have to be that thing. This is actually probably related to what you're saying. Just because you can make it like that, because you can make the panel bombastic, you can do it. It doesn't mean you have to. Like, just tell the story and that'll stand. So I'll skip back the other way because I moved backwards. But Jimmy Olsen was a real treat.
It was a delight.
Yeah, I hope it was as much fun for you as it was reading. I don't see how it couldn't be.
I would sit at the drawing board in a room by myself, laughing out loud, just because what Fraction had come up with was so damn funny. It was a joy. And one of the great pleasures of working with Matt is not only do you get wildly entertaining scripts, you also get weird texts at all hours. that's a big fun part of it. He's got a brain that doesn't shut off, and he just keeps coming up with great ideas. He reworked that a lot. There were several drafts of the first issue before I actually signed on, and then at least three reworkings once I started drawing the book, because of the nonlinear construction of the story. You know, it's built of all these anecdotes that are actually part of one large narrative, but you can't tell that that's the case at first. Matt, moved stuff around between the first three issues and reordered them, and stuff got redrawn and changed, just fine-tuning it like crazy so that it would just, and hopefully all the work's invisible, but man, there was a lot behind the scenes of just tinkering to get that opening as funny as it could be.
Well, you know, because of the fact that it is so many pieces that make up a thing, it's almost like you had to design three times as many books as, you know, you're actually working on. You know, Jimmy has multiple personas and appearances within a given issue. It just seems like a hell of a lot of work.
Oh, it's that's just fun. I mean,
yeah.
One of the tough things for a lot of artists is that you want to be on a long assignment because you want the security and the stability. But, you know, if you're working on the same project for a year, it usually means you don't get to draw in a different style. You don't get to do different tones. You don't get to do different genres. But because of this book, we had sequences that were like a crime comic, sequences that were like a superhero comic, stuff that was like an episode of Little Archie or early Peanuts. I got to be six or seven different cartoonists in the course of telling this one story, and that's just a punch in the arm every time you do it. It's just a constant surge of energy.
It sounds like you still really like to draw and make comics.
Yeah. When I have a good story that's worth telling, I feel like I'm cooking for my family, and that everyone's gonna sit around a big table and tuck it and say, "Oh my God, this is delicious," and I'll get to eat and I'll get to chomp along with them. I love that. It's a great process, and when I'm in the zone, it doesn't even feel like work. It feels like solving, like I used the thing earlier, like I'm solving fun crossword puzzles or something.
I mean, that all reads in the work, I think. And it's one of the, it's funny because, you know, I've talked about comics, you know, on a show every week for well over a decade. And it's really easy, I think. You can see it in the work. You can see it in people talking about it. You see it in fans to get, I don't know if jaded's the right word, but, you know, to lose some of that joy. But every once in a while, you will get comics and you will see just something that makes you happy. It might be a little thing. It might be, you know, like those issues were funny, you know, and funny in a way that I think is really rare. And I find that really energizing, you know, to sort of read comics and know they can still surprise you and still be fun. And, you know, you and Matt Fraction are not, you know, creators I don't know, but, you know, there's still surprise in there. And I really like that. I appreciate that.
I'm always glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Usually, with stuff like this, I'd be getting a lot of feedback in person. I think I was scheduled for seven conventions this year, and so I'm not going to get any of that face to face from folks. I was quite frankly looking forward to people coming up and saying lines from the book to me.
Well, you deserve it.
You sure have created some content too.
That's how we talk now.
Yeah.
Your content was lol. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's a gift, and the reverse of that. I've as a working cartoonist, I've done some projects that were just to pay the bills, and the thing nobody ever tells you is that it's harder to draw a badly written story than it is to draw a good one.
Sure.
It just takes, you know, it takes all the same amount of energy just, for constructing all the panels and making all the pictures make sense. But it doesn't give you anything back while you're doing it, and you're having to put a lot of energy and thought into. It's weekend at Bernie's. You're running a corpse around trying to make people think it's alive.
And you're trying to solve a problem you don't really care about the solution for.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what are you worried about, like, only being the funny guy and not getting to do other things, or sort of what do you aim for now?
I'm more worried that I won't ever get another script as funny as what Matt came up with.
Yeah.
I've had a couple of offers of stuff, and they were all cool projects, but they weren't things that I felt like I was the best guy for. Mm-hmm. So even in this economy, I said, no, that's not for me. Not an easy thing to say no to work at this time, but yeah, I don't want people who read my next project because they like Jimmy to be disappointed because that same magic isn't there. It's funny. One script that was offered to me by a writer whose stuff I love, but when I got it, I could instantly see three other artists doing a much better job on it than I did. Mm-hmm. And that's not me being modest or anything. It's just, I know that there's other folks out there who could make this stuff sing, and the best I could do was kind of hum along with it. And so I had to say, you should go talk to these guys.
Well, I hope that keeps working out for you because, it is a bold stance, but it's the right thing to do. It's not necessarily as the expedient, but.
I've never taken a vacation before in comics. literally, even when we've like rented out a house on the beach on the Oregon coast for the holidays or something, I've put my Cintiq in a suitcase and set it up at the beach house and done 6 or 7 hours of drawing on every day on vacation. Now with Jimmy behind me, I'm finally getting a whole bunch of commissions I'd agreed to do done. And I'm doing lots of those fundraiser drawings that I mentioned at the top of the interview. And waiting to see what the next project is going to be.
Well, I know that you're not going to pick something just for the hell of it. So I'm excited about that. And we'll check it out. I think I'm out of stuff to ask. That's not true. I'm never out of stuff to ask for, but I think I'm gonna let this go before it hits hour three. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Gosh, this is a pleasure. Thanks for all these great questions.
Oh, no problem. Cool. Well, I will be watching out for that next thing. I let everybody know that Jimmy Olsen is fantastic and all sorts of other stuff that you've been going on. So thanks so much for the time.
Thank you. Talk to you.
And that was another great conversation, another episode of Talksplode. I want to thank Steve for hanging out with me, for talking to me and telling me stories. It was a lot of fun. And if you want more from Steve, you can obviously check his comics out, but you can go to Steve_Lieber on Twitter. And thanks so much for the patrons for supporting the show, getting these interview shows out, and everyone for listening. We'll talk to you soon. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also like, one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.